You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. I want to tell you about a great new podcast called Outside the Box. If you're a maker, an innovator, or even just a consumer who wants to peek behind the curtain of some of the world's greatest organizations, you'll love it. The latest episode features interviews with the visionaries who are creating systems that bring our work, and more importantly, our workforce, into the 21st century. Because although we're plugged in at home, when it comes to the workforce, we're lagging behind. Listen to Outside the Box in Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now, enjoy the show. I'm Ben Mathis, and welcome to Kick-Ass News. For decades, my guest today has been a brilliant scientific communicator, consistently illuminating the wonders of nature and attacking faulty logic. Richard Dawkins is an ethologist, evolutionary biologist, author, and tireless champion of reason and science over superstition and humbug. Dawkins is a fellow of the Royal Society and was the inaugural holder of the Charles Simonyi Chair of Public Understanding of Science at Oxford University, where he's now an emeritus fellow of Oxford's New College. He's the recipient of numerous honors and awards, including the Royal Society of Literature Award, the Michael Faraday Prize of the Royal Society, the Kistler Prize, the Shakespeare Prize, the Lewis Thomas Prize for Writing About Science, the Galaxy British Book Awards Author of the Year Award, and the International Cosmos Prize of Japan. He's the acclaimed author of many best-selling books, including The Selfish Gene, The God Delusion, The Magic of Reality, Climbing Mount Improbable, Unweaving the Rainbow, The Ancestor's Tale, and The Greatest Show on Earth. Now in his latest book, titled Science in the Soul, Selected Writings of a Passionate Rationalist, the legendary biologist mounts a timely and passionate defense of science and clear thinking with a career-spanning collection of essays. And on today's podcast, Dawkins shares his wonder for science and reveals how a children's book first got him interested in biology. He talks about his ideas on alien life and warns about a pressing threat to the planet that's not getting nearly enough attention. Then the famous proponent of Darwinism discusses his sheer astonishment that scientists are still having to fight this battle 150 years after Charles Darwin first published On the Origin of Species. He debunks the entire premise of intelligent design and calls on the scientific community to stop calling evolution a theory. He'll talk about Berklee College's recent decision to uninvite him to speak and what he calls higher learning's dangerous elevation of opinion over truth and objective facts. Plus, the well-known atheist talks about his friend, the late Christopher Hitchens. He explains where an atheist gets his moral code and why he's still more than happy to say Merry Christmas. Coming up with scientist, rationalist, and author Richard Dawkins in just a moment. Today I'm talking with evolutionary biologist, author, and science communicator Richard Dawkins. His latest book is a collection of some of his most brilliant and entertaining essays, speeches, letters, and polemics. It's called Science in the Soul, Selected Writings of a Passionate Rationalist. Professor Dawkins, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, you know, I have to ask you about this title, Science in the Soul. In addition to the many other hats that you wear, you are probably the most famous living atheist. Doesn't the concept of a soul go against everything you believe?
There are two definitions of soul. Soul one is the one that we don't believe in, which is the one that survives death, the supernatural one, the ghost. Soul two is the spiritual, aesthetic approach to science, which I think is personified by Carl Sagan, which I aspire to follow.
In one of the essays in Science and the Soul, you actually predict that 50 years from now, science will have killed the soul. I'm assuming you're referring to that first soul, right?
Soul one. Science will have killed the ghost in the brain, but it will not have killed it. Quite the contrary. Science gets ever more wonderful the more we know.
Kill is a pretty strong word. Do you mean that we'll understand the soul or understand consciousness by then? Is that
maybe
what you're
not
saying?
That, but at least we'll be confident that there's absolutely no reason to suppose there's anything supernatural, anything that doesn't follow from the laws of physics.
Well, when you talk about the awe and wonder of science, you have the passion of a preacher, and you almost seem to speak of science with a certain degree of religiosity.
Well, at least poetic. I prefer not to say religiosity, right. But certainly poetic. I've said science is the poetry of reality.
In fact, I think you said that there ought to be a Nobel Prize or some kind of prize on that level for science literature, right?
Well, there may be, but I think the Nobel Prize for literature should go to a scientist. And if Carl Sagan was still alive, mm-hmm. I would be rooting for that.
And you have a couple of essays in the vein of P.G. Woodhouse, yes. Who I'm a big fan of.
Oh, good.
I can't imagine anything more British than that.
No.
Do you think humor is an underutilized tool in your profession?
Probably, yes. And I mean, I hope that those two pastiches of P.G. Woodhouse will be enjoyed in America. I had to change the names. I couldn't use Jeeves and Wooster. I had to call him Jarvis because I was frightened of my learned friend. I'm told the P.G. Woodhouse estate is rather hot on that kind of thing. But I think it's an adequate parody. It's notoriously mm-hmm. difficult to parody P.G. Woodhouse, and I'm quite pleased with those two.
Yeah, it is probably hard to parody it because it is a parody itself of
sort of
class,
yes.
mores and so forth back in that era.
I have Jeeves explaining to Wooster about atheism and Jeeves explaining to Wooster about evolution.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And toward the end there, you have a great little chapter, a little bit called Dawkins' Laws.
Oh, yes.
Do you have a favorite one there?
Yes, I suppose so. Obscurantism in an academic discipline expands to fill the vacuum of its intrinsic simplicity. I mean, that's getting at postmodern literary critics and people like that who have nothing to say and therefore have to language it up and make it all obscure, competing with physics, which really does have a lot to say, and which, well, quite the contrary, physicists trying to explain their subject will make it as simple as possible. As Einstein said, as simple as possible, but no simpler.
Accurate, but relatable to the common man.
Yes.
As part of your role as a science communicator, you talk about the idea of separating ideas from people, and you want to attack the idea, but not the person. Isn't that kind of difficult when these days in particular, it seems like people take their opinions so seriously? It's almost like a personal attack, no matter how you frame it.
Very much so, and that's very sad. People should not do that. They are not their opinions. They are people. I often quote Johann Hari's statement, I respect you too much to respect your ridiculous opinions.
Well, it seems that we have less to worry about scientists attacking people than people attacking science these days. I hear that phrase thrown around a lot lately, science is under attack. As a scientist, do you feel that science is being threatened? And if so, what do you think is the greatest threat?
Well, science clearly is threatened and under attack. I mean, you see this most concretely in the attacks on climate change science, of course, which is desperately important. But I think more than just science being under attack, objective truth is under attack. The idea that there is such a thing as objective truth is being replaced by a ludicrous idea that your own opinion, that everybody's opinion is equally valid, your truth is not the same as my truth, etc. That's pernicious. That way madness lies.
And that gets to something that happened to you, I guess, about 2 weeks ago. Berklee College disinvited you, or I guess the term that they're using now is they deplatformed you from speaking there. Doesn't it seem ironic to you that academic institutions are canceling outside speakers who somebody might disagree with, and yet at the same time, within the universities themselves, there's also this ridiculous trend toward embracing subjectivism, and instead of defining truth as an absolute, they're using these wishy-washy terms like your truth and my truth.
To be fair to UC Berkeley, it was not they who deplatformed me.
Okay.
although they have been known to do that several times now. Mm-hmm. It was a radio station which is in Berkeley.
Okay.
And it is not actually associated with the university. But otherwise, yes, what you say. So, I mean, certainly a university is a place above all where ideas should be open to discussion from all sides, argument, criticism. To deplatform somebody because you anticipate that they may say something that will upset you goes right against the whole spirit of a university and is highly deplorable.
Yeah, so it was like a preemptive strike in just in case you might say something that might offend someone.
Yes, which of course I was not going to do because my book doesn't have anything about that.
Right. I believe, if I have this right, you began your career actually teaching at UC Berkeley way back when, and you actually participated in the protests against the Vietnam War there.
Yes.
Were you a little surprised that now suddenly you're the one being protested?
Well, yes. I mean, I was there for 2 years in the late 60s, shortly after the free speech movement. Free speech. I hardly need to expand on the irony there. Yes, I took part in various protests at the time. So I think it's very sad what's happened to universities generally, and particularly Berkeley. I deeply love the place, and I actually loved the particular radio station which was there, and which was which was well known for its fact-checking scrupulousness and for its honesty. And in this case, they simply didn't fact-check. They took the word of for all I know, it was a single protester, and just simply cancelled my thing without even looking to see what I'd actually said.
Oh, wow.
Which was very different from if you actually see the context.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one thing for universities or groups within universities to want to censor people for their opinions or their political leanings. But it almost seems like this is a more alarming front in that war, in that it's an attack on science and reason itself.
I think so. Yes.
You know, as a scientist and a rationalist, what do we have if we can no longer frame the truth in objective terms then?
Well, we have to fight against this tendency. And part of it comes from current political climate, and we have a president now who's a chronic liar, probably doesn't even know he's lying. He may even believe his lies. But we also have academics who, while not actually sponsoring lies, nevertheless are sponsoring this idea that truth has no objective validity. The truth what do they call it, socially constructed, that kind of nonsense.
Mm-hmm. In the age of alternative facts and fake news, where is the measure for reality?
We have a kind of pincer movement from right and left against the value of objective truth.
I'd be interested to hear where your interest in science came from. I read in Science and the Soul that apparently Dr. Doolittle played a role inspiring your early love of biology, huh?
As a child, I loved Dr. Doolittle. I loved both the fact that nowadays he actually reminds me of the young Charles Darwin, and they're sort of roughly contemporary. And there's a sort of resemblance there, both great naturalists, both scientists, curious scientists. But also Dr. Doolittle taught me really to be suspicious of speciesism, which is analogous to racism, the idea that humans are somehow so special that they deserve a kind of moral barrier around the species Homo sapiens, which doesn't apply to any other species. So, for example, a beginning human embryo, a zygote, is regarded as being a person, which commands more moral respect than an adult chimpanzee. Then that's just nonsense. That's moral nonsense. But not only hasn't been born, but hasn't got a nervous system, can't feel, can't think, can't suffer.
I guess you must be an animal lover from reading the book. You talk about fireworks, your dogs and fireworks and whatnot.
I should say a non-human animal lover, because we are, of course, animals.
It's funny. What is it about fireworks that drives animals crazy? My dog, just the other day, when it was July 4th, I mean, fireworks go off and it's like he goes through PTSD or something.
Exactly. I mean, well, it's hardly surprising. The immensely loud bangs, these are utterly foreign to anything that the dog is used to.
Yeah.
And to think of all the wild animals that are going through it as well, at least your dog has human comforters to sort of soothe and placate, whereas squirrels and raccoons and mice and squirrel and everything are just no doubt terrified out of their minds.
Yeah, and I wonder, is it also because dogs have better hearing than we do that it probably sounds louder?
That might well make it worse, but you don't need to postulate that.
We talked about growing up, your interest in science and biology and zoology. Do you still get that thrill? What are some of the recent discoveries or advances in science that get you excited?
I'd get the thrill from natural history. I get a thrill from going to Galapagos, where I'm going in a few months' time, and going to jungles and seeing wild nature. The whole diversity of nature, tropical rainforest and things like that, just amazing. But you ask about science. I mean, what excites me about modern biology is molecular genetics, which is a branch of computer science now. I mean, you know, in retrospect, I think we could probably say that it had to be that way. Huh. You couldn't, I don't think evolution by natural selection could possibly work unless genetics was digital. Mm. It turns out that it is digital. Very, very digital, totally digital, and highly accurate. And that's totally fascinating, the analogy between genetics and computer science.
Yeah, and that's interesting because you talk about the potential for alien life on other planets. And perhaps because it is so simple in that sense, it is digital, perhaps that's all that there is. You know, if there's extraterrestrial life, you theorize that it's probably unlikely that it would be alien in the strictest sense of the word, right? It would probably be the same DNA structure.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, there's a chapter in the book called Universal Darwinism, which uses the idea of what would life be like on other planets to look at the general principles. I would not expect DNA. I mean, I think that's going too far. Okay. I would expect digital genetics of some kind. But it might be based upon a different principle, a different actual structure than DNA. Okay. I would certainly predict it will predict Darwinian natural selection. It'll be some kind of Darwinian natural selection, maybe different in detail. But I think Darwinian natural selection is the only way to get adaptive complexity, which is the most important property of life. And I think that in turn depends upon digital genetics, although probably not necessarily DNA.
Okay, but if it were, say, Mars, I think that you said in here that what we might find would be the product of cross-contamination or
well,
a distant
that
relative
is,
of us,
amazingly,
right?
That is possible because we now know that rocks have arrived from Mars, that meteorites that have hit this planet have come from Mars. We know that because the chemistry of the rocks is identical to the chemistry that have been found in rocks from space probes to Mars. So that is possible. If we found life on Mars that had DNA with the same genetic code, the same triplet code, 64 different letters, different words, that would, to me, prove beyond doubt that it was cross-contamination. If it was merely DNA with a different genetic code, then I would think that would be an independent invention of a DNA code.
Talking about asteroids, one of the things that you warn against in this book as probably the most serious threat that we're not paying enough attention to is the danger of a cataclysmic collision with some type of extraterrestrial object, right?
Yes, I learned this from Rusty Schweikert, the astronaut who's very much involved in it. A catastrophe as large as the one that wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago is unlikely in any one lifetime. It's going to happen at some point, but you know, every 20, 25 million years ago or something. But a catastrophe big enough to wipe out a city is much more likely. And that sort of catastrophe happens every few centuries. Wow. And so it probably is worth worrying about, particularly now that we do have the technology, A, to detect it coming, and B, to do something about it. You don't have to do very much. You merely have to speed it up a little or slow it down a little in order to make it miss. And we pretty much know we can do that because we know that we can. The European Space Program did succeed in landing a spacecraft on a comet. And so if you can do that, you can probably give it a nudge. and we probably ought to be thinking about doing that.
Now, are the smaller asteroids or objects that would take out a city harder to detect than, say, the type of asteroid that destroyed the dinosaurs?
Of course, certainly, yes. And so
there's a challenge there.
Yes. It's not that they come shooting straight at us and you can see them coming. They have an elliptical orbit, as do we, except our orbit is almost circular. And so what you have to do is measure the orbit of asteroids and comets and work out whether their elliptical orbit is likely to intersect with ours at some point in the future, which could be hundreds of years into the future.
And like you said, it only takes a nudge to knock it off course.
Yes,
so
yes.
It wouldn't take some enormous amount of energy to
divert
an
asteroid. That's a surprising fact.
Yeah, it's contrary to what one might think for an object like that.
Yes, just a slight speed up or slow down. If you speed it up, it goes on a slightly wider elliptical orbit. If you slow it down, it goes on a slightly narrower elliptical orbit.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Richard Dawkins when we come back in just a moment. Hey guys, do you hate shopping for clothes? Well, now there's an easier way to get better clothes, Bombfell. Bombfell is an online personal styling service that helps men find the right clothes for them. And unlike other services, there are no fees to work with them, so it costs nothing to sign up. It's simple and straightforward. All you have to do is complete a questionnaire, and a dedicated personal stylist will handpick pieces specially for you. Then, once you've viewed your selections, you'll have 48 hours to make any changes or even cancel altogether. You're in total control, and you only pay for the clothes you keep. Plus, you have the option of receiving clothes once every 1, 2, or 3 months because Bombfell is on your side, and they don't make money if you don't find something you want to keep. I just got my first order from Bombfell. I gave my stylist my measurements and answered just a few questions about my style and what I like. He came back to me with a hand-picked outfit just for me. My stylist selected a beautiful sports jacket made out of high-quality linen, perfect for the summer, along with a button-down and a polo shirt that go great with my new jacket or on their own. I was able to change the color if I want, and if I'm ever not in love with the selection, I just say so and my stylist comes back to me with a totally new selection. And these weren't some weird off-brand items. We're talking quality, fashionable clothes that fits great. Plus, it was easy and fast, and I didn't have to waste a lot of time in a store. I love good clothes, and that's why I really love Bombfell. Best of all, I've negotiated with Bombfell to get my listeners a special offer of $25 off your first purchase when you go to bombfell.com/kick. That's Bombfell, spelled bombfell.com/kick. And now, back to the show. Well, you've fought for the teaching of Darwin's theory of evolution for your entire life. And then somewhere along the way, I guess creationists tried to throw you for a loop with this new idea of intelligent design.
I don't know why I call it a new idea. It's exactly the same idea.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Isn't it kind of a cop-out in the sense that they've realized that Adam and Eve and a talking snake is a losing argument? So now they're kind of – it almost seems like they're hedging their bets and trying to reframe creationism by misappropriating the language of science or pseudoscience.
Very much so,
repackage it.
Yeah, very much so. Including, by the way, the dishonest ploy of pretending that this is not the God of Abraham they're talking about. This could be any it might even be an extraterrestrial intelligence, which of course it could be. But if it were that, then the extraterrestrial intelligence would itself have had to have evolved. So it's just pushing the argument back a stage.
By that argument, then, there's no such thing as just a being that came out of nothing and created us.
Yeah.
It was just a chain reaction of evolution, really. Huh?
Yes.
Do you think that an alien could have created us?
It was suggested, I think, semi-tongue-in-cheek by Francis Crick and his colleague Leslie Orgel, directed panspermia. They postulated a kind of science fiction idea that some alien civilization, which had been evolving long before ours started, perhaps foresaw their own extinction and sent a space probe out with a nose cone containing bacteria which seeded our planet. It's a science fiction plot, really. It's not totally impossible, but I doubt it.
I am amazed at the clout that these creationists and intelligent design believers have in the face of settled science. Where was it, Alabama, where the state and the school board voted to put these ridiculous flyers in all of the biology books?
Yes, I have
kind
a chapter.
Of countering.
That's right. I have a chapter called The Alabama Insert. What this was, as you say, was that the Alabama state government, I think, decreed that all biology textbooks should have a bit of paper stuck in the front, which says, in this book, it will discuss Darwin's theory of evolution. and you don't have to believe it. Here's what you should believe, kind of thing. And when I arrived to give a talk in Alabama, I didn't know about this, but somebody told it to me and thrust this page into my hand, and I read it. So there and then I threw away my prepared talk and instead went through the Alabama insert line by line in front of the audience, destroying each line of the insert. And that's a transcript of my speech is in the book. It's called The Alabama Insert.
What were some of the arguments that they put out there?
The usual yeah. ones about fossil record having gaps and, and everything being terribly complex and things like that.
Yeah, they also say that it's just a theory, that you know, that it's not necessarily a fact.
Yes,
it's
that's
really
a very
science,
unfortunate thing. Right? I mean, my view is that we've got to stop calling it a theory. Mm-hmm. The orthodox response to that is to say scientists use the word theory in a different way from lay people. And right. that's not cutting any ice. That's not getting anywhere.
Yeah.
And so I think we've got to stop calling it a theory. It's not a theory. It's a fact. It's a fact. It's a fact.
Yeah.
It was a theory in Darwin's time in the popular sense of a tentative hypothesis. Yeah. Now it is a fact.
You know, if a theory's been around long enough and not enough scientists have spoken out against it, it's an approved theory or something like that.
Coming, and massive, massive, massive evidence in favor of it.
Yeah, now intelligent design proponents use this I argument, saying that the I is irreducibly complex and therefore I guess it couldn't be the product of evolution. What's the argument?
Yes, well, Darwin dealt with that in The Origin of Species very, very comprehensively. He didn't call it irreducible complexity, but he meant it. It was the same thing. Couldn't come about by evolution, therefore the default is it must have been created. I mean, that's, of course, totally illogical thing. You have two theories, theory A and theory B. You find a weakness in theory A. So you say, oh, it must be theory B that's right then, although you don't even look at whether there's any evidence for theory B. As it happens, there's nothing wrong with theory A, which is evolution. The I is one of the most beautiful examples of how natural selection, gradual evolution, can produce an eye. I dealt with it at great length in my own book, Climbing Mount Improbable.
I'll tell you, I don't get the resistance to evolution because for me, I actually find the idea of Darwinism uplifting in the sense that it shows not just that we did evolve, but that we can evolve, that we continue to evolve. We're not just stuck here.
Yes.
We're constantly adapting and improving. I think that's a very hopeful thing.
I agree. I mean, Darwin himself said there is grandeur in this view of life. And I agree with that.
You know, I've had guests on the show who are atheists. I've had guests who are believers, Christians, Jews, Muslims. And the latter would say that they get their code of conduct or their moral compass from their ancient religious texts. As an atheist, where do you derive your sense of morality?
I hope they don't get it from their religious texts. And they don't. I mean, of course they don't. If they did, they would be stoning people to death for breaking the Sabbath and for committing adultery and things like that. Of course they don't. They haven't read their ancient texts if they really think they get their morality from it. We all of us get our morality from the same sort of source, which is a very complicated mixture of sources. We never get it. Nobody gets it from their holy book. We get it from moral philosophy, from jurisprudence, we get it from parliamentary debate, we get it from conversation journalism. There's a kind of, I've called it the shifting moral zeitgeist, which changes all the time as the decades go by. You can recognize our morality today as 21st century. If you go back 100 years to 1917, you'd find a very, very different way. People would have spoken in sexist ways, in racist ways. Warfare was conducted in truly horrific, even more horrific than it is now. Killing civilians was the name of the game. Nowadays in warfare, we still have warfare, unfortunately, but if you kill civilians, it's a matter for apology. Things have moved on, and they've moved on not because of religion, but because of this shifting moral zeitgeist, which, as I say, is some kind of complicated mixture of things. Things almost hovering in the air, you could call it metaphorically.
Yeah, that 100 years ago, women didn't have the right to vote.
Exactly.
200 years ago, we still had slaves.
Yes.
We could easily speculate on what types of things that are common right now would be taboo 50 or 100 years from now. In your opinion, what do you think some of those things might be?
Well, the obvious one, I suppose, is the way we treat non-human animals. And there's a pretty close analogy between racism and what we can now call speciesism.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be my guess, my bet.
I wonder, are you a vegetarian?
Or, I'm aspiring to be vegetarian.
You're aspiring vegetarian.
I'm vegetarian at home, so all my own cooking is vegetarian.
Okay.
But when I go out to dinner with friends, I don't put them to the trouble.
It can definitely be socially isolating.
I'm kind of moving in that
sometimes.
Direction, but I haven't got there yet.
But not vegan, right? Because vegans say that
they
look
eggs.
Down on the vegetarian.
They won't eat eggs and milk and cheese and butter and things like that.
Right. No, how do you feel about that? Well, That's not an imposition on the animal? What's your thought?
I suppose that meat, to actually kill an animal, to eat the animal itself.
Right.
But a vegan would say, well, keeping hens for eggs is cruel, and keeping cows for milk is cruel. So that's the difference.
Right, but we're also feeding them, so it's sort of a symbiotic relationship,
is
it not?
It is indeed, yes. And from a Darwinian point of view, you could say that cattle are an enormously dominant species in the world, and they're using us.
Yeah. Well, you argue in a chapter called The Guided Missiles of 9/11 that the world would be a lot safer without religion. Explain how you see that.
Well, this was written just almost like the day after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to make the point that religious faith, the belief in life after death, in particular the belief that if you die a martyr's death, you're going straight to the most privileged corner of paradise. And it's no wonder that if people really, really believe that, which they do, if you really believe that, then you would do all sorts of appalling things in order to claim that reward. And so I'm very quick to say I'm not saying that all religious people are dangerous. Of course I'm not saying that. But religious faith is dangerous because it only takes a minority to really, really sincerely believe that the best way to serve their God is to kill infidels and whatever it is that they say. Then they will do it, and they'll think they're righteous. They don't think they're doing wrong. They think they're doing the most right possible thing they could be doing.
Yeah, I mean, there is something very perverse about incentivizing violent suicide.
Yes, I think it's rather amazing that it works, but it clearly does work. They clearly do really, really sincerely believe it. Sam Harris makes the point that in Christendom, we've rather forgotten what it's like to really, truly believe all that stuff. But in the Islamic world, they really do believe it.
You know, here in America, every December, it seems, the conservative news media or Bill O'Reilly starts running these stories about the supposed quote unquote war on Christmas.
I've got no time for that.
Yeah.
I've got a chapter in the book called Merry Christmas, and I'm happy to say Merry Christmas. We've got better things to worry about than having a war on Christmas. If there's ever been a war on Christmas, it tends to be by rival religions rather than by atheists. But I'm not sure there even is a war on Christmas. There certainly shouldn't be. I'm very happy to say Merry Christmas, everyone.
If a city hall removes a manger scene or a school takes down a Christmas tree, then that is another front on the supposed war on Christmas.
Yes.
Do those things bother you,
tree? No, these are what are called first world problems. I have no time for this kind of petty fussing around.
Yeah, in fact, it may surprise, I think, some people that in that chapter you mentioned, you say in a secular society, we can still have Christmas, but we celebrate these things as a cultural holiday, perhaps like we celebrate Halloween these days, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't like the celebration. I hate this sort of profligate giving of presents anyway. It's extremely wasteful, and it's okay for children, but not otherwise. By the way, December the 25th is Isaac Newton's birthday, so you could celebrate that.
Yeah, I think that's what Neil deGrasse Tyson tweeted that out and got a bunch of guff from people over Christmas. Well, you end the book with a tribute to your friend and fellow atheist, the late Christopher Hitchens. Is there some part of you that maybe wishes there were an afterlife so that you might see him again?
Yes, of course. That would be very nice. The book is dedicated to him, as you say. And so I just added this little postscript right at the end of the book about Christopher Hitchens. This intrepid warrior for truth, this cultured, courteous citizen of the world, this devastating, coruscating enemy of lies and cant, well, maybe he has no immortal soul. None of us has. But in the only meaning of the word that makes any sense, the soul of Christopher Hitchens is among the immortals.
In that sense, the soul lives on.
In that sense only.
Now, I threw it out to a few of the listeners if they had any questions for you. In the interest of time, I'll just read one here. Bob asks, how does one raise an atheist child in the U.S., or I guess for that matter, anywhere? Do you assert your opinions to the child, or do you simply allow the child to explore on his own and come to his own conclusions?
I was once at an atheist conference, and there were children there because people had brought their children. And at one point, somebody on the platform said, all you atheist children, come up on the platform. And I blew a gasket. I was furious. We don't have atheist children, just as we don't have Catholic children or Muslim children. We shouldn't have. Mm-hmm. Teach the children to think critically for themselves. Think mm-hmm. for themselves. Teach them science. Teach them about evidence, about rationality, about logic. And they'll come to the right conclusion in the end. Don't force atheism on them mm-hmm. any more than you would force religion on them. Mm-hmm. Children should not be indoctrinated with the opinions of their parents. They should be taught how to think, not what to think.
Mm-hmm. Should they be exposed to religion, though?
Yes, they should be exposed to religion because it's a very important part of history and literature and current politics, but not indoctrinated in any particular religion. Just told religion is there. This is what mm-hmm. some people believe. This is what other people believe. This is important in history. It's what led to various wars in the Middle Ages and later. You'll find lots of references to the Bible in English literature, which you may recognize.
Now, you yourself were raised as a Christian when you were a child, and then I think around your teens you became an atheist. What was the realization that did it for you?
I don't want to exaggerate my upbringing. I mean, my parents didn't indoctrinate me. I was sent to Anglican schools like most people in England were. And so went to chapel every week and think every day, actually. For me, I think it was learning about the true scientific explanation for life, because I was always very impressed with the complexity and the beauty of life. And I, before I understood about Darwinian evolution, I thought that indicated a divine creator. It was when I finally understood the real reason, the real explanation, which is evolution. That's what finally knocked my religion on the head.
Well, before we go, you're credited as coining the term meme. Will you consider your life a terrible waste if you go down in history as the father of the meme?
Yes, rather. Yes. I've sought to explain science as clearly and as vividly and as poetically as I can. And I've tried to encourage the love of evidence and the love of logic, the love of rationality. And so the meme is only a small part of it.
Well, that's a far better legacy, I think. Well, again, the book is called Science in the Soul, Selected Writings of a Passionate Rationalist. Richard Dawkins, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Richard Dawkins for joining me on the podcast. Order his book, Science in the Soul, Selected Writings of a Passionate Rationalist on Amazon. Learn more about the Richard Dawkins Foundation at richarddawkins.net and follow him on Twitter at Richard Dawkins. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Don't forget to take our listener survey. It only takes 5 minutes at podsurvey.com/kick. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on your social media. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickassnews or click on the donate button at kickassnews.com. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, though, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.